What's up, ladies and germs? welcome back to the pod. I know nobody is going to probably ever listen to this podcast because I don't think I'm going to tell anybody that I'm recording this podcast again. Not because I'm embarrassed, but because I'm at the point where I just want to talk and get my thoughts down because I have a lot of them and I don't have, you know, not everybody wants to hear me talk all the time. So I'm just going to talk and I'm going to get my thoughts down. I'm going to talk. There's a lot of playoff stuff. It's been quite literally like 2.5 years since I recorded a podcast on here. And I'm so looking forward to like not having to edit a bunch and just letting my plain thoughts go, because that's what I used to do for the podcast. And it would take me hours to get a pod out because I was so worried about like every single little sound, like every single weird sound my mouth made. I had to edit all that out. Now I'm just chilling. I'm just cooling, and I'm going to talk playoffs, and I'm going to give my opinions. And if anybody ever hears them, awesome. And if nobody ever hears them, I don't really care. I'm just happy that I get to talk to a microphone and say these thoughts out loud. And maybe one day I'll look back on them and be like, hey, I was so right. Or, hey, I was so ridiculously wrong. And that's going to be fun. And honestly, this is just good. It's fun. It's fun for me. So 2024 playoffs is going on. Second round is coming to a close. We are nearing the conference finals. We need to talk about what we saw last night. It was Denver-Minnesota game 6. Minnesota had won the first two games of the series in Denver. Defending champs, Denver Nuggets looked like they were on the ropes. And then they went and snatched 3 in a row, including 2 on the road in Minnesota. It looks like Minnesota had their soul taken from them. Had all of their heart, their soul, their everything snatched from them. And then wouldn't you know it, they come right back home and beat Denver by 45. They were up by as much as 50 points in this game, which is ridiculous. They might have even been up more than 50 in this game. I stopped watching after the third quarter because it was done. That game, it didn't catch me off guard. I thought Minnesota was going to win this game. I picked Denver in 7, so obviously for there to be Denver in 7, there has to be Minnesota in game 6. But I didn't expect it to be this much of a blowout. I think Minnesota really bought in and hung their hat entirely on the idea that role players play better at home. I know it didn't really happen in games 3 and 4. It actually kind of was the reverse in this series, but I think they really had to hang their head on something because the defense that they were running on Nikola Jokic just was not working. He was dicing them up 3 straight games. And I know the games 3 and 4 didn't really look like he was dicing them up. He had somewhere between like 20 and 25 points in both of those games, but the shooting percentages was elite. He was finding his teammates. He was rebounding. He was controlling the pace of those games. And then obviously we know what he did in game 5. 40-point trip dub with no turnovers. Like, that's just ridiculous. You can't really do anything about that. But we'll get to guarding Nikola Jokic later. I think they really just said, we're going to double him. We're going to double him tonight, and we're going to pray that his teammates don't hit shots. And the reason they're able to do that is because Anthony Edwards is locking up Jamal Murray in this series. Jamal Murray has not scored 20 points in this series. In not a single game has he scored 20 points in this series, and that's because Anthony Edwards is not only doing what he's doing on the offensive end, he's also doing it on the defensive end. Now, I do think it's really important that they blew Denver out last night, because what comes with guarding Jamal Murray is it's a lot very taxing for Anthony Edwards, which is why his series has been kind of up and down. He'll score 35 points one game, and then he'll have a 19-point dud in the next game. But I think the fact that he was able to sit most of the fourth quarter, if not all of it, and the fact that he still got his work in, he hit, I think, 3 of 5 or 4 of 5 threes the other night. He was shooting a good percentage, and he was getting his teammates involved. And what really happened is he was able to open up the floor for a Jaden McDaniels to have 21 points, or for a Karl Anthony Towns to be able to do work on the rebounding end. Even though he didn't score the most points that he's had in this series, you felt Cat's impact in this game more than you felt it in games 3 through 5, which was really important for them. But I think the key thing here is that Minnesota just doubled down and said, we're not going to let Jokic score. We're not going to let it happen. We're going to turn him into a passer, which I don't know if is really the thing that you want to do long term. But they said, game 6 on the road, we know the crowd is going to be loud. We know the environment is going to be tricky to deal with. We're going to bet on Minnesota's role players not hitting shots. And it worked out for them. Michael Porter Jr. was bottled up. Christian Braun was bottled up. Aaron Gordon didn't have a great game. Obviously, Jamal Murray didn't play well. Nobody really played well. Hell, they scored 70 points. So nobody really played well. Jokic did about as well as you could do in that type of environment. And Minnesota is really the only team that's able to actually double-team Nikola Jokic and still get away with it, because They have three big bodies that they can throw at him in Rudy Gobert, Karl-Anthony Towns, and Naz Reid. Although it appears that Naz Reid and Karl-Anthony Towns are more impactful than Rudy Gobert is, who is the Defensive Player of the Year four times, by the way, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. As for Game 7, I have no idea what this Game 7 is going to look like. I have absolutely no clue who's going to win this game, because now Minnesota has all of the momentum. Minnesota has all the momentum going into this Game 7. Denver, everybody's talking about how Denver just took a gut punch and they might be hanging their head. I don't think so. I think Denver knew that this was going to be a tough game, and I think Denver has been put in tough situations before. They came back down 3-1 twice in a single playoff run. Like, this Denver team knows how to deal with adversity. They were just down 2-0 in this series going into Minnesota. So I don't think Denver's rattled. I think Denver knows, hey, we gave it our... Well, actually, they didn't give it their best shot, but, like, we played. It didn't work out for us. We're going to go home. We're going to take care of business Game 7. They have... I believe Game 7 is tomorrow, Saturday. So they're going to see... Maybe it's Sunday, actually. I might be lying. It's in a day or two. So they're going to see what happens. I don't think that in order for Minnesota to win this game, they cannot play the same way they played in Game 6. And I know that sounds weird, considering the fact that they won by 45 points. But they won by 45 points because Jokic was hitting people and they weren't making shots. That's not going to happen in Denver. Like, to score 70 points, I understand Minnesota is a great defense, right? They're one of the better defenses we've seen in the last decade or so. I won't go so far as say this is the best defense in the last decade, because I think people were overstating it with that take. I still think the Warriors in 2017 or in 2016 had a better defense. I still think some of those Spurs teams in the early decade had a better defense. But this is a very good defensive Minnesota Timberwolves team. That being said, if you score 70 points in a game, you're not locking up a team to 70 points. That team is missing shots. They held Minnesota to 80 points earlier in the series, and I actually think that was a better defensive effort than this was. So, I don't know. I don't see Michael Porter Jr. playing as poorly. I don't see Jamal Murray going 1-for-10. I think I want to lean Denver in this Game 7. I know I picked them initially, but this is not how I expected this series to go. I expected it to be 3-3 going into Game 7, but how it got there, not what I expected at all. So I don't know how this is going to go. But since we're on the subject of defense, a lot of people were saying that Minnesota played a flawless game, and I disagree. I think Minnesota has a big problem, and I think it's Rudy Gobert. People always, every single year Rudy Gobert wins Defensive Player of the Year, or at least it feels like it. And every single year people go, when are we going to finally start giving this man credit for his Defensive Player of the Year? He's one of the greatest defenders of all time. No, he's not. He simply is not. It's the most misleading four-time Defensive Player of the Year winner ever. And I know that sounds like I'm just hating, but when you're a defensive liability come playoff time, it's really hard for me to put stock into the four regular season awards that you've won for your defense. I'm sorry. Because teams very clearly are doing, they do the same thing every year, and Rudy Gobert cannot adjust to it. They don't put Rudy Gobert on the perimeter in the regular season, so he doesn't have time to make adjustments come playoff time. And then come playoff time, it's just pick and roll. It's pick and roll central. Pick and roll Rudy Gobert. Pick and roll Rudy Gobert. Pick and roll Rudy Gobert. They were lighting him up. They were even finding some success in the Phoenix series. Unfortunately, they just couldn't do anything else. Denver, the last three games before Game 6, were killing Rudy Gobert. The Timberwolves had their best defensive effort of the playoffs and probably of the season in the one game that he missed. In Game 2, where they held Denver to 80 points on their home court without Rudy Gobert. That is their best defensive effort of the year. And it was without their Defensive Player of the Year because they couldn't take advantage of him on the perimeter. And then even when he's not in the perimeter, he's so lazy. He's such a lazy defender. The reason I say he's lazy, I'm watching him get out-rebounded by Michael Porter Jr. I'm watching him get out-rebounded by Jamal Murray. The last part of defense is securing the rebound, and he's the tallest guy on the court with the longest wingspan on the court. He should be getting 14, 15 rebounds a night in this series, and he's not. Also, he's also lazy. The defense that Minnesota likes to play on Jokic, or at least they played with him the first five games and why it wasn't working, especially in games 3-5, they would stick Cat on Jokic. And I'm not faulting Gobert for not guarding Jokic straight up, because it's better to have a help defender who is as long and has a wingspan as wide as Rudy Gobert's is to then come in and double-team Nikola Jokic before he can make any decisions and hopefully force him into a bad pass or even a turnover. Or maybe just make him miss a shot, take a bad shot. The problem is, and this even showed in Game 6, in the earlier parts of Game 6, Rudy Gobert is so slow getting over on those double teams. I don't think it's a coaching thing, because every other person who double-teamed Nikola Jokic in Game 6, especially Game 6, did it quick. And that's what you have to do with Nikola Jokic. You can't give him time to sit there and make decisions, because that's what he's the best in the world at that, man. You're not going to beat him if you give him time on the block to let everybody cut or decide to make a move or do whatever the hell he wants. You can't give Nikola Jokic time. You got to be quick with your double team. You got to flash and get back. And, like, listen, I know it's difficult, but damn, man, you're supposed to be the best defender in the world. You've won 4 DPOYs. Can you guard him once? And very clearly he can't, because the one time that they put him on Jokic to guard him straight up, he scored 40. He scored 40 points. And it's just... People ask me, why am I so hard on Rudy Gobert? This is why I'm so hard on Rudy Gobert. Because he's not a good help defender. He's only good when someone finds him driving the lane and he can swat a shot. He's a good intimidator. I'll give you that. He's a good intimidator for people who are 6'7 and below. Other than that, people know he's soft. People know he's soft, and people know he's slow, and people know he's lazy. And they use that to take advantage of him. And I don't blame them. It's the strategy that you should go for if you're a coach worthwhile of your money, is to abuse Rudy Gobert in the pick and roll and make him make decisions in the post, because he's not good at it. He's just not good at it. And it's really sad that he's taken 4 Defensive Player of the Year awards away from the likes of Giannis, away from the likes of Draymond Green, away from the likes of... I don't know. Anybody else who deserved to win it over? Who else was in the running this year? Bam Adebayo. He probably stole some from Bam Adebayo. Stole some from... Oh, Anthony Davis. 100% should have had some. Like, it just sucks, man. I understand it's a regular season award, and I understand that that's what you get rewarded for, is your performance in the regular season for this trophy. But at some point, people got to stop asking the question, why don't we respect Rudy Gobert as a defender? It's because of months April through May through June. Like, that's why we don't respect Rudy Gobert as a defender. Because he doesn't show. He doesn't show, and I think it's going to cost Minnesota in this series. I think Denver's going to expose Rudy Gobert the same way they've been doing most of the year. One last thing that I wanted to talk about with this series before we move on. There's been a lot of comparisons drawn from Anthony Edwards to one Michael Jordan. A lot of these comparisons have been saying that he is the heir apparent to him. I disagree. I think Kobe was obviously the heir apparent. But if there's going to be a modern-day version of Michael Jordan, I very clearly see the comparisons to Jordan and to Kobe's game. Likewise, some people have compared him to Dwayne Wade. I do see some similarities to Dwayne Wade, but I think Donovan Mitchell plays more like Dwayne Wade. I don't think Dwayne Wade was as vicious and tenacious as a slasher as Jordan and Kobe were. I think he was much more willing and liable to pull up from mid-range than to drive. That's not to say Jordan and Kobe didn't pull up from mid-range. They had some of the best mid-range games in NBA history. But I think Wade would have rather settled for a mid-range game, and he developed that more as his career went on, whereas Jordan and Kobe were attacking the basket their entire career. And I know that has to do partially with health and Wade's knees giving out early, but Kobe's knees gave out early, and I never saw that man less than 3 feet away from the rim if he could take it. So I think he plays more like Jordan. I also think he's more athletic than Dwayne Wade. I think he's got the Jordan-Kobe athleticism. Like, there was a clutch up and under dunk that he did against Denver in game four that it reminded me of Michael Jordan. I swear I've seen Michael Jordan do that exact dunk before. It was ridiculous. The move that he pulled on Michael Porter Jr. last night, and then to take it to the rack and dunk it like that, it is Jordan-esque. And I'm not saying he is Jordan. Obviously, I'm not saying he's Jordan. He just plays like him. And he has... The thing is... That separates him. Obviously, the Michael Jordan archetype of a player is not necessarily unique, right? It's the slashing two guard who has a great mid-range game, and can shoot from anywhere he wants on the floor. Like, we've seen a bunch of players like that. Like, Paul George played like that, and DeMar DeRozan played like that. The difference is the mentality. It's the mentality that Anthony Edwards has, that he shares with Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan, where it's like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to kill you doing it, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. And I'm going to keep doing it until you're so tired that you can't do anything about it anymore. And then I'm going to talk shit to you and tell you that you can't guard me. That's the mentality that makes him something, that makes him the player that people want as the face of the league going forward. And I can't blame people. He's personable. He has the mentality. He looks like he wants to win. And he's got the skills to boot. So this wasn't even what I wanted to talk about. I just needed to sing Anthony Edwards' praises for a minute. But this playoff series, and especially this rivalry with the Denver Nuggets for Anthony Edwards, really does kind of mirror Jordan's career. Jordan took a little bit longer to find this much playoff success. And I say that, and I don't say that to say that Michael Jordan was a bum. I mean, he scored 69 points against, 63 points against Larry Bird in his first playoff series. But I mean, to find this type of success with this good of a team this early in his career, Jordan just didn't have that. He just didn't have as good of a team before the Bulls drafted people like Scottie Pippen, got people like John Paxson over and Horace Grant to come and help Michael Jordan out. But this rivalry with the Denver Nuggets really does kind of mirror Jordan with the Pistons a little bit. It really does. The first year in 89, Jordan and the Bulls said themselves in the Last Dance documentary they were not ready for the Pistons in the conference finals that year, and they lost to them in six. Last year, Minnesota Timberwolves, fresh into the playoffs for the first time since Jimmy Butler, lost to the Denver Nuggets in the first round after giving them a decent... it was a tough five-game series with Anthony Edwards hitting a dagger in game four, I believe. And then Denver just closed it out at home after that. So... apologies if you hear music in the background. That is my roommate. but I think that's the similarity there. And then this year, we're just deciding, is Anthony Edwards going to do this 1 year early? Is Anthony Edwards going to beat his Detroit Pistons in two tries instead of three tries like Michael Jordan did? Again, this is not a shot at Michael Jordan for not beating the Detroit Pistons earlier. The Detroit Pistons were a championship-level team. But... We're a multiple championship level team. Sorry, with multiple Hall of Famers on their team. They were a very good team. There's no Michael Jordan hate here, okay? And argument can be made that if Scottie Pippen plays Game 7 of 1990 Conference Finals, Bulls win that game and Bulls win the finals that year. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Denver Nuggets just came off a championship last year, their first championship. Detroit Pistons came off their first championship in 89 after they beat the Chicago Bulls in the Conference Finals. The Denver Nuggets beat the Minnesota Timberwolves in the first round on their way to the finals win. This year, Anthony Edwards and the Minnesota Timberwolves pushed the defending champions Denver Nuggets to seven games. Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls in the 1990 finals pushed the Detroit Pistons to seven in the conference finals. That was the Scottie Pippen migraine game. Who knows how this is going to turn out? If Anthony Edwards goes up to Denver and wins game seven on Denver's home court... He's accelerated where he should be at his point in his career. He's already passed where he should be at this point in his career, but now he's really stepped on the gas. Because that, if he manages to beat this team with Rudy Gobert as an active member on his squad, that's very impressive. That's one of the most impressive playoff victories for a young player in at least recent memory. At the very least recent memory. I can't think of anything that would equate to this. Other than Mike in the early 90s, I can't think of anything else that would equate to this. So it's just to be seeing if it's going to map directly onto Jordan. It's like, this is assuming they meet Denver next year, which I think is a fair reason, fair possibility if everybody stays healthy to say that these two teams are on a collision course next year. Or if he accelerates his timeline, beats Denver this year, and then goes on to possibly win a championship in just his third year, fourth year in the NBA? That would be... He's well on track to being one of the greatest ever. I know it's early to say that, and I understand he's like 22 years old, 23 this summer. He's got that talent, and he's got that motivation, and he's got that mindset. I'm very much looking forward to the next 20 years of Anthony Edwards basketball. Very much. We're going to move to the East real quick. Actually, not real quick. We're going to move to the East now. We need to talk about the one team that has actually made it to the conference finals, has advanced to the conference finals so far. That would be the Boston Celtics. They beat the Cavaliers in five games, with Donovan Mitchell missing the last two games, and a plethora of other players missing the final closeout game five in Boston. I know this is weird to say, considering that they are the one team who is actually qualified to make the conference finals at this point, and they are a very, very well-rounded, stacked team. The Boston Celtics have, to me, been the most disappointing team of the playoffs so far. And I know that's weird, like I just said, especially considering the fact that they've won both of their series in five games. But the fact that both of these series were five games, and that they were fairly close series throughout, is embarrassing for Boston. And I understand Boston lost Kristaps Porzingis in this series, or before this Cavs series. It shouldn't have mattered. It shouldn't have mattered. Evan Mobley was not playing well until the last two games. Jared Allen wasn't even playing in this series at all. So it's not like Cleveland had their big guys up front. Boston should have swept the Cavs. Boston should have swept them. I can understand losing one game to Miami. I don't like the fact that they lost the one game to Miami at home. But I can understand Miami had the greatest shooting night in the history of their franchise in their playoff franchise history. Like, how you're not supposed to be able to beat that. Like, at least it was close and they didn't get blown out. Game two in Boston, where they didn't just lose to Cleveland. They got worked by Cleveland in Game 2. They got worked by Donovan Mitchell and Cleveland in Game 2. And I understand they came back and beat them in Game 3. Donovan Mitchell gets injured in that game. Lord knows, they only lost by 13 points. Lord knows what happens if Donovan Mitchell doesn't get hurt in that game. I'm just so always disappointed. Like, it's just always a... with Boston. Like, I expect them to be so much better than they are. They should be wiping the floor with this Cleveland team and getting as much rest that they need, that they're going to need for this Knicks series coming up. Because, yes, I do think the Knicks close this game out tonight in Indiana. We'll touch on that in a few minutes. But especially since Boston has the worst habit of playing down to their competition. Because some of the closest games in this series were when Donovan Mitchell was out, were when Jarrett Allen was out, were when... who was the last guy that they missed? I don't know, but they missed a bunch of players for these last two games of this year. Caris LeVert, when Caris LeVert was out. When Cleveland was basically missing the whole roster. Game 4 and 5 were some of the closest games. Cleveland was within one possession and held leads in the fourth quarters of these games. That should never, ever, ever, ever happen to a Boston team that is supposedly this good and has these championship aspirations. It should never, ever happen. And so I walk away from this Boston Celtics team, and I should be feeling like they're the dominant powerhouse in the East. And instead, I'm feeling like if the Knicks win tonight, and if they had OG Anunoby, I might pick them to beat Boston. I genuinely mean that. And is that partially because Boston doesn't have Porzingis? Yes, I think Porzingis is a big game changer. But the other side of that is, when is Porzingis ever continuously healthy? He was fairly healthy throughout the regular season. He missed a decent amount of time, but like, for him, it was healthy. The fact that he was able to play in some playoff games is big for him. I'm not going to let them use the Porzingis isn't healthy excuse. They knew that when they bought him. They knew that when they brought him in and then extended him after that. They knew that was going to happen, so they better have some backup plans. But instead, they trade away Robert Williams, and they get Jrue Holiday, which I think has been a very underrated piece for them this year, which was one of their biggest acquisitions of the summer. But I've been so disappointed by this Boston team. Derek White is playing well, and everybody else is letting me down. Especially, who's supposed to be their star, is Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum should be under the most pressure of anybody in these playoffs. And it just doesn't feel like anybody is really understanding how that is. It is shameful. It is absolutely shameful that the Boston Celtics have not won one of the last four championships in the NBA. It's actually, or at the very least, it's shameful that they've only played in one final series. And if anybody has the right to say that, it's me as a Warriors fan who kicked their ass in 2022. Like, I don't understand how a team with that much talent... Let's go back to 2020. Should that Jimmy Butler team really have beaten that Celtics team in the bubble? No, they shouldn't have. Let's go to 2021. What happened in 2021? Oh, in 2021, they were bad. Yeah, they had a bunch of injuries. Okay, well, we'll let 2021 slide. For the last 5 years, it's a travesty. 2022, awesome. They made the finals. Absolutely melted down the last three games of that final series. Was that partially because Steph Curry is him? Yes. But was it also very poor decision-making and iso ball and hero ball and bad coaching and bad just player management overall? Yes. Then Boston Celtics choked their best chance in 20 years. Oh, excuse me, since 2008 to win a final series. They absolutely choked it. 2023 is the biggest, the worst example of this. You let a Miami Heat 8-seeded team beat you on your home court in Game 7 by 20 points to go to the NBA Finals, in which you matched up much better with the Denver Nuggets. The whole world wanted a Denver Nuggets-Boston Celtics final series. And we might get that this year, but it just doesn't feel the same as it would have last year. And I know people are going to tell me, oh, Jason Tatum got hurt in Game 7. Who knows what would have happened if Jason Tatum doesn't get hurt in that game? Why was he playing in that game? Why did the Boston Celtics allow an 8-seed team to push them to 7? Why did the Boston Celtics allow an 8-seeded team to go up 3 games to nothing? To nothing on them. They were the 2-seed. They were the 2-seed. I'm not discrediting that Jimmy Butler-led team, because Jimmy Butler's a hell of a leader. Jimmy Butler might be one of the 3 best leaders we have in the NBA right now. Actually, he is one of the 3 best leaders we have in the NBA right now. That still does not excuse what the Boston Celtics did last year, or excuse me, failed to do last year, because they failed. They ultimately and utterly failed last year. And I don't understand how there wasn't coaching changes made after last year. I don't understand how Joe Mazzulla is still coaching this team, because I don't see any improvements this year. I see them coasting on their talent, and eventually, when a team comes around that wants it more than them, it's going to nip them in the ass. Because it was just such This is awful. They should be killing these teams. They should be killing these teams. They should be murdering these teams, not playing down to competition that is so far beneath them. Do you know how much worse the Cleveland Cavaliers are on paper than this Boston Celtics team? And the Cleveland Cavaliers aren't even like the nitty-gritty, do the dirty work team that like a Miami Heat team is. If Jimmy Butler plays in that series, I guarantee you that series goes seven, and Lord knows what happens in that series. Boston is very lucky Jimmy Butler didn't play in that series. But they got through it, fine. They got to play who's ahead of them. I'm not blaming them for that. How do you lose game two on your home floor by 27 points? I don't even care that they won the next three games. They should have done that in the first place. I don't trust this Boston team. I think whoever comes out of the West beats Boston. I genuinely believe that. I think Dallas beats Boston. I think OKC beats Boston. I definitely think the winner of Minnesota-Denver beats Boston. I don't know what to think of this Boston Celtics team. I don't believe in them. I think they're the fifth best team left in these playoffs. I genuinely believe that. And honestly, this Knicks team is good, man. This Knicks team with OG Anunoby, they could do some problems to Boston. If OG Anunoby gets healthy by game three, I might have to revisit this pick I'm about to make. Because I do think Boston beats this Knicks team in like five or six games. Because I think the Knicks are just so worn out. I'll talk about this in a second. I think the Knicks are so worn out at this point. Like, Tom Thibodeau, great coach, plays his players too much. He plays them way too much and then wonders why they're all hurt come playoff time. You playing them 100 minutes a game, man. Like, no duh, they're hurt. So I think if this Boston or this Knicks team, as well coached as they are, and as much as they clearly love to play for Thibodeau, they might need a different coach if they want to do something like this, because if they want to win a championship, because I don't think Tom Thibodeau playing his players the way he plays them is ever going to win a championship, because it caused Derrick Rose to get hurt. It's causing the New York Knicks to go down one after another. So at some point, it's an 82-game season, and then it's a long playoffs, man. It's a long, grueling playoffs. So your body gets worn out. Your body just gets worn out. I don't think Thibodeau realizes that, and I think that's what's going to cost the Knicks in the end. Now, that being said, New York Knicks have a chance to close out Indiana tonight in Game 6. I think they do that, but the reason I think they do that is because they better beat this Indiana team tonight, because they've just gotten 3 days of rest since their last game against Indiana. That is the most rest they've had between games this postseason. They need to take advantage of that. They need to close out this Indiana team while they have fresh legs, and then they have a day to rest before they go play Boston in Game 7, or Boston in Game 1. Otherwise, it's Game 7 versus Indiana on Sunday, and then it's Boston on Tuesday. That sounds dreadful. If I was a New York Knicks fan, I would be begging and pleading with whatever god you worship to let them win this game tonight, because they got the 3 days rest, which is great. If you play a game, you're going to be tired, but it's not going to be as tired as you would be if you play two games, including a grueling Game 7, and then you have to go up to Boston and play in TD Garden Game 1 on a Tuesday night or a Tuesday afternoon. That sounds dreadful. New York better win this game tonight. I think they do. I think Jalen Brunson comes out and has fresh legs. I think the role players play a little better with fresh legs. And I think they edge out this Indiana team that, let's be honest, lucked out of round one because Giannis and Damian Lillard were hurt. The fact that Chris Middleton and company even pushed that to five games is kind of a miracle. Yes, we did expect more out of the Bucks. I'll talk about that in a second. But Indiana kind of lucked out of round one. Tyrese Halliburton's going to be good for a while. He's kind of shrunk in these playoffs, but I still do believe that there's something nagging him with his injury that he sustained. I think after this offseason, he'll be a little bit better. I do want to talk about the Bucks real quick before I go to this OKC-Dallas team series. Listen, I love Giannis Antetokounmpo. I think he's fantastic. I think the fact that he can just run and dunk on anybody at any point in time and is the defensive player that he is and is the type of team leader that he is great for the league. And I think it's fantastic that he's won a championship to prove how great he is. And I think he's been robbed of a couple more defensive player of the years by one Rudy Gobert. That being said, Giannis Antetokounmpo has a problem. And it's not the fact that he can't shoot worth a lick. We've already proven that for his game, that's not really a problem at this point. When you're that much of a freak of nature, do you really need that much of a jump shot? Like, maybe it'll impact him later in his career, but for right now, he's fine. No, Giannis' problem is that he's getting a pass for being injury-prone. Did you know that since 2022, when they got bounced by the Celtics in the semifinals, Giannis has not played a full playoff series? Giannis has not played a full playoff series. And I understand he's only played two playoff series and got bounced in both of them, but him being injured is a major reason why they got bounced in both of those series, once to the Heat in round one last year, as the one seed, by the way, and this year to the Indiana Pacers as the three seed. Giannis is not playing these games. Like, we talk about, we give Anthony Davis a ton of flack, and rightfully so. I genuinely believe that he is injured sometimes. Like, I do genuinely believe that most of the time when they say he has an injury, he is injured. But it comes a point, like, the best ability is availability. You got to be available to play these games, and it comes to a point in time where you can't just keep getting a pass for being injured all the time. Fix something with your diet, with your training, with the shoes that you're wearing, something. And it looks like AD this year, maybe it was some of the coaching of Darwin Ham. I know we don't like to give Darwin Ham a lot of credit, and rightfully so, but maybe he did something to relieve AD of that stress, because he played upwards of 70. I believe AD played 75 games this year. He wasn't injured that much. AD figured it out this year. Giannis has not figured it out since 2022, and he was injured a lot of the 2022 regular season. So when are we gonna stop giving Giannis a pass for missing these games? Because it's cost them two playoff series now, which they had genuine title hopes. I know this year was weird with Doc Rivers and his questionable coaching choices, but if Giannis plays in those series, there's a very good chance they beat Indiana. There's a definite chance. There's a very good chance they beat Miami last year and stop all this hate that I've been giving Boston. There's a good chance they can win the championship last year if Giannis plays. There's a very good chance Denver is not a champion right now if Giannis plays in the playoffs. So I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not saying Giannis isn't great, but I am saying one more playoff run where he's hurt. I think this conversation already needs to be brought up. One more playoff run when he's hurt, there needs to be some serious either observation of the medical staff in Milwaukee or observation of what Giannis does in his free time. Because I understand he's a tank and he's built like a tank. He keeps getting hurt, man. He needs to change his play style if he can't play the way he's playing, he needs to change the way he plays. Maybe he does need to develop that jump shot. Like, maybe the down the road that I was talking about was already here. Because he is in his, 10th season in the NBA now? This was his 10th season. If he's already failing to hold up after just 10 years in the NBA, and I know 10 years in the NBA is a long time, but he just hit his prime, 5 years ago? Could it be another very short prime situation? Maybe he got his ring and he's content with that. I don't know. But he might need to fix something. Speaking of fixing something, this Bucks team needs to fix everything, man. I understand it's been a year, and I understand they probably won't do this, but I wouldn't blame Damian Lillard for not wanting to play in Milwaukee anymore. That's not to say Damian Lillard performed exceptionally well this year for Milwaukee. He had his ups and downs. He has probably his worst year one of his first couple seasons in the NBA. He didn't play well. He didn't shoot the ball well, but I don't really blame him. There was a lot of inconsistency with that Bucks team this year, from the head coaches to the players they were throwing into these lineups, from just the stories we were hearing coming from that locker room where they don't respect Adrian Griffin, and now they don't respect Doc Rivers, and they want this person promoted, and Giannis was advocating for Darvin Ham to go be the coach, and it's just a lot of miscommunication and misfunction going on in that Bucks locker room. I wouldn't blame Damian Lillard for saying, you know what, F this, get me out of here. And then the team that I thought Damian Lillard was going to go to all along, and where I still think he wants to end up in, Miami. I think that becomes a very real option again. Would the Bucks trade him to Miami is the big question. I would think no, but Miami has a lot that they can offer. Miami's got some picks. Miami's got some young players. I think Tyler Hero proved his worth enough in these playoffs to either warrant some trade value. I think his trade value had diminished last season, which is why I think the trade for Dame last offseason didn't go through, but I think Miami's got some pieces to make the trade work. So I'm not saying he'll go there. I don't think they'll send him to Philly. I don't think the money works there, and I also think they have Tyrese Maxey as their point guard. I don't know, man. I think Dame could be on the move again this offseason. I wouldn't be surprised if those rumors were swirling around him again, and I wouldn't blame him for wanting out. If he went to the front office and said, yeah, this isn't working, I'm done with this, wouldn't blame him. Wouldn't blame him one bit, because he's right. It's not working, especially if they're going to bring Doc Rivers back, which they shouldn't, by the way, because Doc Rivers is a chronic underachiever. He's been riding the highs of that 2008 championship for so long. It definitely doesn't help that he had at least three future Hall of Famers on that team. But whatever, yeah. Doc Rivers was the reason they won that championship, for sure. They shouldn't bring him back. They need a better coach. They need a better roster construction around Giannis. And they just need Dame to play better if he is going to stay. If he's not going to stay, honestly, Bucks, you might need to blow it up. I'm not saying trade Giannis, but Chris Middleton's on the board. Chris Middleton's also hurt all the time, by the way. He was hurt all the time in the regular season. His production completely fell off a cliff. I understand part of that is because Dame wasn't there, but if Dame is struggling, Chris, you want to help out? Giannis averaged 31 this season. Could you get it up to 19, 20 points a game? Could you manage that three-time All-Star, Chris Middleton? Just asking. Okay, moving on to OKC Dallas. This series has been a wild ride. What a crazy ride this series. First, the Thunder blow Dallas out, and everybody is singing about how Luka Doncic is overrated. And then Dallas comes and beats OKC two times in a row, one in their own stadium, one a nail biter at home. Dallas has 2-1 lead, and suddenly everyone's like, Thunder were frauds, worst one seed of all time. And then the Thunder win game four. Thoroughly, when they come back in the fourth quarter and they beat Dallas on their home court, Luka Doncic struggles. And now everybody's like, oh, see, we told you the Thunder were real, and we told you Luka Doncic, he's not him, he has playoff struggles. And then the Dallas comes back in game five, and they win on the road. And it's been such a flip-floppy series, but I think what I come away from this is that the Thunder are still a piece away. Like, this team is very good, and I think they've overachieved early, and I think a lot of people would agree that this team and Orlando are probably the two biggest overachievers early. With that being said, they're very clearly still a piece away. Shea is amazing. They need another shot creator. They need somebody else that can go out there and get their own shot when Shea is struggling. Or when the defense double-teams Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, they need somebody who can go out there and say, I'm going to get a bucket. Now, is that person Jalen Williams? I don't know. He struggled in these playoffs to create his own shot when he's needed to. His scoring average is down 5 points from the regular season. His percentages are also down from the regular season, three-point and field goal percentage. So I don't know if he's him yet. Maybe it's bright lights. Maybe it's young. It's a young player not quite being able to adjust to the playoff atmosphere, because they didn't get a real test from the New Orleans Pelicans in round one. They swept them. They swept them fairly easily, and most of the games were not close other than game one. So I don't know. This Thunder team still feels like a piece away for me. I'm not 100% sold on Chet Holmgren yet. I know he's been great all season, but I still don't know how well his flimsy little legs can hold up that frame that goes flying all over the place. So I'm not doubting his ability. I'm doubting his health. I'm doubting his ability to stay healthy. So this Thunder team could look very different next year. I don't think they're going to trade everybody and blow it up. I don't mean that. I think the injury bug could hit this Thunder team next year, because I think they got very lucky and stayed very healthy this year, which is not their fault. You need a little bit of luck to find success in the NBA. But I think without a real shot creator, like a true secondary shot creator, I'm not saying that can't be Jalen Williams. I'm just saying it's not Jalen Williams yet. I don't think this Thunder team can really do anything massive. I think they would beat Boston, because I think Boston beats themselves. I think of the teams in the West, Boston would probably have the easiest time with OKC. But that being said, I don't think OKC is coming out of the West, so I don't think Boston's going to have to get... I don't think Boston's going to have that delicacy. I think the Dallas Mavericks are going to win this series. I think Dallas closes them out in Game 6. And I think Dallas moves on to play Denver, who I think is going to beat Minnesota on either Saturday or Sunday night. Yeah, that's really all I had to talk about that series. There's not really much else to say. Kyrie Irving and Luka Doncic have fit together this season much better than they had last year. And I just think it's a good fit. I think they've constructed that roster well. The additions of Daniel Gafford and PJ Washington have obviously paid dividends, most evidently PJ Washington in this series, because Luka has the lob threat, and he has somebody that he can trust is going to be there when he's double-teamed. Obviously, Kyrie is that, but Kyrie's small, right? They have a big body that they can trust, can go to the basket and score them 20 points when they need to, then can score them 27 points when they need to. I think that's really big for Luka, because he hadn't really played with somebody who played like that. He had Porzingis, but Porzingis is like a 6'4 shooting guard trapped in a 7'1 center's body. So I think this is big for Luka. I think this is the team that he trusts the most, and I think they give Denver a fair go in the Western Conference Finals. I'm not ready to pick that series, because obviously that series hasn't started yet, because both of those teams are still playing. But I'm willing to bet that it's Dallas-Denver in the Western Conference Finals. And I'm excited to see how that series goes. I think those are the two of the three best players in the world, depending on what your opinion is, in Luka and Jokic. Okay. So I want to talk about Philly very quickly. They clearly need another piece. I think the ticking clock is running on Joel Embiid now. I think that fraudulent MVP that he got last year is looking even more fraudulent. That being said, I do think if he doesn't get hurt this year, he wins another MVP. And I think he would have deserved it more than the one that he got last year. Because I think the one that he got last year was given to him by a false narrative created by Kendrick Perkins on First Take. And we'll get to talking about First Take and the narratives they want to create at the end of this podcast. But I think it's very clear that Philly needs another piece to alleviate the load from Joel Embiid. It's very clear Tobias Harris has not worked. It's very clear that Kelly Oubre established himself with some trade value this season. I think they should trade him as soon as possible. They should trade Kelly Oubre and package him with Tobias Harris to make money work as soon as humanly possible. Not because Kelly Oubre has been bad for them this season. On the contrary, he averaged 20 points. He played fairly well in the playoffs, and he's averaged a couple steals a game, I believe. That's the most value they have on their team, aside from Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid, who they're obviously not trading. That is their 1-2 punch. They need to everybody else should be on the table. Every single other person should be on the table for the Philadelphia 76ers, because they are very much in win-now mode. And when you have a player like Joel Embiid who gets hurt every 20 minutes, you need to be in win-now mode for the next 6 or 7 years, however much longer you can get out of Joel Embiid's body. Because he's shown that when healthy, he can play well in a playoff series. Now, I'm not giving him a pass for this year, as a lot of people would like to, because they're going to say, oh, he was hurt. I don't buy the you were hurt allegations when you can score 50 in a playoff game. I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all. I do believe that he was hurt. I'm not saying that he wasn't hurt or that he was faking it. I don't believe he was hurt to the point that it could have impacted his play that much. Because if you can dominate the team for 50 points and then you can go and play poorly against them the next two games, I don't believe the injury bothered you. I believe that's a mentality thing. Tyrese Maxey, that series should have been over in 5. Tyrese Maxey saved it and prolonged it so Joel Embiid could maybe save them in game 6, and he failed to do so. So I'm still casting blame on Joel Embiid for this postseason run. I'm not casting it as much as I'm casting it for, say, a 2020 or a 2022 or a 2021 postseason run, but he's got a share of the blame this year for sure. They need another piece. Paul George is looking to be on the market. Mikal Bridges might be on the market. I think both of those players can impact winning for them very quickly. The Philadelphia 76ers should have Mikal Bridges already. They traded the rights for him in the draft, 6 years ago now? They should have Mikal Bridges, but anyways, they should be targeting him because Brooklyn is going nowhere and should be looking to sell now. There's a lot of players that I think could help out the Sixers, and I think they should go and do trades this offseason. They should not stand pat and run it back. They should go and make trades, or otherwise they're going to face another playoff disappointment like this, and they're going to cast even more doubt on the validity of their MVP player. Last team that I want to talk about here is the team that everybody apparently loves to hate so much, is Phoenix. And no, I'm actually not going to talk about the Warriors and the Lakers in this podcast, because they've been gone for so long that we don't even really need to talk about them. The only thing that I really want to talk about with the Warriors is their WNBA team that they've just received, but I'll get to that in the discussion after this. So Phoenix, what's going on, guys? Like, this team is just completely stuck in the mud. They should sell. It's a house fire. They need to start a house fire and they need to sell everybody. And I mean Devin Booker too. And I know that's might sound sacrilegious because that's their whole franchise. The franchise is lost. They played this whole year without a point guard. They didn't go out at the trade deadline and get a point guard for their super team. Their quote-unquote super team. Which is just ridiculous to me. I don't understand. They got Isaiah Thomas at the last leg of the season and never played him. I don't understand what the Phoenix Suns are thinking, and for their owner to come out and say after they just got swept that everything is fine with this team and they don't need to make changes is atrocious. It's actually the most mind-numbing thing I might have heard all year. It's genuinely, how can you get swept in the first round of a playoff series when you have Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, and Devin Booker on your team and say, yeah, we're fine? No, you're not fine. That's horrifically poor roster construction on the part of the Phoenix Suns, and they failed Devin Booker. And don't believe me, I'm not the biggest Devin Booker guy. I think Devin Booker, outside of the Chris Paul years, is a perennial loser. I genuinely do believe that. I think without a true leader, Devin Booker doesn't do anything. However, can he be the best number two option in the league on a championship team? Hell yeah, I think he could do that. I think if Devin Booker went to Philly, that's a problem. That's a problem for the rest of the league. That team, I would favor that team to win the championship. If Devin Booker goes to Milwaukee, that's a problem. That's a big, big, big problem. Who else could use Devin Booker? Miami could use a star in general. Miami just needs a shot getter. They need a bucket getter, shot creator. Like, Damian Lillard and Devin Booker fit the description. And they have point guards that they can run. Jimmy can run point guard for Miami. The problem for Phoenix is that they didn't have a point guard on their roster the entirety of this year. The whole season they didn't have a point guard. They gave Devin Booker point guard responsibilities. And I'm not saying Devin Booker cannot pass. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying he can't distribute, because he averaged, what, 7-8 assists this year? He averaged, I think, even more than that in the playoffs. He was a good distributor of the basketball. The problem is that's not his game. His game is getting fucking buckets. That is Devin Booker's game. That's what he's best at. That's what he's one of the 10 best people in the world at. He's a bucket getter, shot scorer, demoralizer. That's what he is. And he wasn't allowed to do that because they had to run the offense through him. He was getting Kevin Durant shots, which he was missing, and he was trying to get Bradley Beal shots, which he was missing, and the majority of his offense came one-on-one, which is exhausting, one, and two, inefficient. It's just, it's really, really bad roster construction on the part of the Phoenix Suns, and Devin Booker needs to be playing off-ball. Like, I'm not saying he can't play on the ball and that he can't distribute and make some decisions and beat people off the dribble, but Devin Booker is the best when he's running off screens, catching the ball, turning, making decisions, and shooting. That's what Devin Booker is the best at. So he needs to be put on a team where he can do that, because if you're going to be on a team where Devin Booker is your point guard, you're not going to find success, because the most likely thing is that your best scorer is passing the ball to everybody else, and that's not what you want. As for the other two superstars, I don't even know what they do with Bradley Beal. They might just have to eat this Bradley Beal contract, because he's got a no-trade clause. I don't know who thought it was a good idea to give Bradley Beal a no-trade clause. Maybe Washington's a genius and Phoenix is an idiot for agreeing to that deal for Bradley Beal deal. But wow, like, I know Washington sucked this year, but they're looking like they fleeced Phoenix, because Phoenix has no direction, and at least Washington has a decent young core, half decent young core that they can build on now, because Jesus Christ, they fleeced Phoenix. So I don't know where the hell Phoenix can send Bradley Beal that he would agree to go. I don't know if anybody would even want Bradley Beal. He didn't even play the majority of the year, and it looks like his best years are behind him. So they might just have to eat that Bradley Beal deal, or just cut him. Just cut him and use the roster spot on like a pick or something, even though they don't have any picks. I think the player that they can get the most value out of, aside from Devin Booker, obviously, but they're not expected to trade Devin Booker this time, is Kevin Durant. And I know Kevin Durant's been passed around like a blunt recently, and that's his own fault to a degree, but they got to get something. They need some draft picks, man. They need some youth. Like, call up Atlanta and be like, hey, do you want KD? Do you want to win now? Please give us the number one overall pick. Or at least the number 8 overall pick or something. Oh, no, that's San Antonio's number 8. Call San Antonio. Do you want another 7-foot freak to pair with your already 7-foot-4 freak? Here, just give us the number 8 or the number 4 or both, and we'll throw in a Torrey Craig. Here, have Torrey Craig, too. Have a veteran leader. And Eric Gordon. Have a shooter. Just please give us some draft picks, because that's what they need. And then you can call Atlanta after that, be like, hey, have 4 and 8 for one. And then, I know this draft class isn't, like, the greatest ever. Maybe trade for, like, the 2025 class. But, God, man, you need something. You need some youth on your team, because you're lost. What I think is the most likely, or at least something that's not the most likely, what I think is underrated move, could KD come back to Golden State? I know I said I wasn't going to talk about the Warriors, but hell, maybe I'm a little biased. Could KD come back to Golden State? I think if there was ever a time for KD to come back, it would be now. He's on the tail end of his career. So is Steph. I think the league is at a point where they've agreed that these guys are a little bit on the back end of their prime. Even Steph showed some inconsistencies this year with his shooting ability and his ability to stay healthy, which I don't love to admit considering he's my favorite player. But I'm able to see that the shooting percentages were down and he wasn't able to quite get to the rim as efficiently as he had in past years. I think the league has agreed that obviously Klay Thompson is past his prime, and Draymond Green looks like he's on the tail end of it as well, although he can still hold up defensively with the best of them. It's not a super team if Kevin Durant goes to the Warriors. Like, even if Kevin Durant goes to the Warriors next year, they're not favored over Denver. They're not favored over Boston. They're not favored over Minnesota or OKC or maybe even Dallas. Maybe even the Lakers they're not favored over next year. But I think that if the Warriors were to be able to trade for Kevin Durant, I think that would be a fairly successful trade. I think, for if anything, it would be a feel-good trade, you know, like a get-the-gang-back-together trade and see what could happen. And then another thing that I think the Warriors could sneakily do, which I think they might even have their eye on, just as funny, there's one thing the Warriors are pretty good at. They're pretty good at developing players. They're pretty good, have a pretty good player development team. They've developed the likes of Jordan Poole and Gary Payton Jr., and Moses Moody. They're doing a decent job with Jonathan Kuminga. Their one big failure, obviously, was James Wiseman, but they just don't know what to do with centers, which is why they've run without one for the last 10 years. If the Golden State Warriors, they have a second-round pick this year, I believe. They went out and snatched Bronny James. Could you imagine if the Warriors drafted LeBron James' son and developed him into the two-way player that people are saying that he could be? Because they say that he is an NBA-caliber defender. They're saying his offense lacks and his ability to read the game lacks, but he wouldn't be playing right away. He'd be sitting behind the likes of Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Draymond Green And I'm assuming Chris Paul isn't going to be there next year, but let's say even if Chris Paul is there next year, and probably Andre Iguodala has his influences in that team, and the Kevon Looney's and Steve Kerr's, he'd be sitting behind those people. You don't think he'd learn anything from them? You don't think he'd learn? He'd be sitting behind Gary Payton. Gary Payton could be his mentor, because Gary Payton's great, but he gets hurt all the time. I think it's a pretty good spot for LeBron James Jr. to want to end up. Miami is also, I say Miami like everybody should go to Miami, but like Miami's just got such a good culture, and I think Bronny James would fit very nicely in that culture, especially behind the type of players that they have. Minnesota would be nice for Bronny too. So I think there's a lot of spots that you could go. I just think it'd be kind of funny if the Warriors drafted him, just considering, you know, obviously the history of those two, that team and that team and that player in LeBron James. All right, so for these last couple segments, I'm going to move away from the NBA for a minute. I'm going to talk about the NBA's counterpart and the WNBA. Obviously, a very prominent player has made their debut in the WNBA, and that would be Caitlin Clark. She's played her first two games. She's averaging 14.5 points on like 30% shooting and like 20% shooting from three. It's not great. She has not played well, but to be fair to her, she went against the best defense in the league in the Connecticut Sun in their first game. And then they went against the New York Liberty, who were the runners-up for the NBA championship, in her second game. And guess what? She's going to play them again tomorrow, on Saturday. So it's probably not going to go much better. They got blown out both games. And I don't care. I do not care. Caitlin Clark's first game played for the Indiana Fever, where they got blown out by the Connecticut Sun, was the most watched WNBA game since 2004. In 20 years, it was the most watched WNBA game. Caitlin Clark is going to be what Michael Jordan was for the NBA. I'm not saying she is Michael Jordan. I feel like I have to make this statement every time I bring up the name Michael Jordan, or else it's sacrilegious. She will not be Michael Jordan. Okay? But she is going to do for the WNBA what Michael Jordan did for the NBA, and that means she's going to popularize it. She's going to globalize it, because Larry Bird and Magic Johnson saved the NBA, don't get me wrong. Like, they saved it with their rivalry in the 80s. But Michael Jordan was the first player that they saw and said, that is God walking earth. That is God playing basketball in the NBA. And that is what I feel Caitlin Clark is going to be for this next generation of people who watch the NBA, and especially for women who play basketball. Because I think she's going to be so pivotal in popularizing women's basketball. She already has done it. She was a college player and had millions of people tuning into her games, whether it was to hate or to cheer her on. And the reason I know that it's working is a lot of the discourse surrounding WNBA is very toxic things. Like, oh, if I was playing that, it'll get some, like, 13-year-old teenage boy from, like, Massachusetts or something. And he's on his phone on Instagram, like, if I was playing in the WNBA, I'd average 40 and I'd win the championship every single year. These women suck. Like, that was the discourse around WNBA players. The discourse around Caitlin Clark, people are hating or loving on her for her game. Like, some people are my favorite thing in the world is to see people call Caitlin Clark overrated because she can't play defense. Because that means they're actually paying attention and watching the games. Like, that was not what you got in the WNBA before that. So, I think she's already started to do it, and I think she's going to be fine in the league. I think she's going to have a little bit of rust getting into this season, because she just played a very long college season. So, I think it was due that she wasn't going to, you know, hit the ground running right away. But I think she's going to be fine, and I think the better that she plays, the better it's going to be for women's sports overall. It's already looking like she's having an impact with these two WNBA teams that got introduced. I believe one is in Toronto. I don't know if they released a name for that yet, but the one in Golden State is the Golden State Valkyries, which, one, awesome name. Two, awesome logo. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's a pretty cool logo. And I think that is not only going to help the league, but it's also going to help Caitlin Clark a little bit, because expansion teams water down the competition a little bit, because there needs to be more players put in. So obviously more players doesn't necessarily always mean the best players put in there, but I think expanding is a good move for the WNBA, and it's a good move for Caitlin Clark, because it's going to help her kind of even out the competition a little bit. But next year, Paige Bueckers is eligible for the WNBA, and she's looking like she's going to be the number one overall pick, and it's looking like the Golden State Valkyries will have a very good chance of landing that number one pick. And if that happens, I don't know if you guys know this, but Paige Bueckers is my favorite women's basketball player. If that happens, and they draft Paige Bueckers, I'll be watching very closely because I love the way Paige Bueckers plays. I think she, I thought I was out on the, out, I was found multiple times saying that she was better than Caitlin Clark. Obviously, Caitlin Clark got the best of her in the game. However, I do think that a very poor moving screen call was the result of that. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I think that's going to be a rivalry for the league to watch, for the WNBA to watch. That could be their little magic bird rivalry. Who knows? We'll see how it goes. I think the WNBA is, for the first time in a long time, trending upwards. And I think that's a good thing for women's, not just women's basketball, but women's sports overall. I think it's a very good thing. The last thing that I want to talk about today is not basketball related, really. It's about football, but it's not really football related. So Harrison Butker, who is the kicker for the Super Bowl champion, three-time Super Bowl champion, Kansas City Chiefs, gave a commencement address at a college, I believe it's called National Catholic University. Let me see if I can find that. Sorry, Benedict College in Atchison, Kansas. Okay, Benedict College in Atchison, Kansas. And in this commencement speech, he was addressing not a very large class, a small to medium-sized class of obviously religious. It was a religious school. And he's in there. He opens the speech discussing, obviously he congratulates everybody, and he discusses adversity that people face and how bad leaders who don't stay in their lane have a negative impact on society. And how he's mainly talking about how believing in God, you can find the transcript yourself at National Catholic Register. This is where I'm reading it off of. How believing in God and, you know, committing to your faith can help you guide yourself through the atrocities that we face in the world. And if that was his speech, there is nothing inherently wrong on face value with that. But then he proceeds to make multiple comments that are at the very least controversial, discussing how Pride Month and homosexuality in general is a dangerous sin on the earth, and that it is shaming men and taking away masculinity. And he goes ahead and talks, but he makes a statement in here that says, I know the women in here, specifically calling out the women in here. I know some of you might be looking forward to starting your careers, but if I had to guess, the vast majority of you are looking forward to just having children and being mothers and wives to your husband and living the life that your husband dictates for you, because he goes on to claim that this is what his wife has done for him. Also, I'm not just making this up. You can read the transcript if you'd like. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing, but I don't want to read his whole thing here. So he goes on to say that his wife would also, he goes on to say, yes, it's true. Maybe my wife's dreams didn't come true, but if she had the opportunity, she would laugh at you and say, there's no way I made the wrong decision. And because of this, because of his one example being his wife, he goes on to then make the judgment that that is the best way to serve God, is to give up on your hopes and dreams and to be a mother and a wife to your husband. And that is what your best role in life is as a woman. And that's what you should be looking forward to after having just gotten your education, gone through 4 years of college and education, albeit at a Catholic school, where they probably share some of those same values. I'm not hating on Catholic schools. I'm just saying the values are the same here. You've just got your education, and now you should be looking forward to none of the things that you work towards, and instead you should be looking forward to being a mother and a wife solely, because that's the best way to live life through God's eyes. I'm not claiming to be a religious person or to understand how religion functions, because I'm not a religious person, and I'm not even going to make comments on the comments that he made about homosexual people and the LGBT community. I disagree with his comments. I disagree with them saying that they are a dangerous sin on the world and that they're a threat to masculinity. I disagree with that, but I'm not here to discuss the political aspects of his speech, though I would condemn them because I think they're ignorant and stupid. I'm here to talk about the thing he said about women should just should only be looking forward to that. Should only be looking forward to motherhood and wifehood, and that giving up on their dreams is an okay thing to do because his wife did it, and she would make the same decision again. I'm not here to say that if a woman chooses to just be a mom and be a wife and be a stay-at-home mom, that's a failure of a life. That's absolutely not what I'm saying. That's a very good and honorable and necessary life for some people to live. And some people don't have a choice, and that's what they have to live, and that's perfectly fine. I'm not shaming the people who choose to do that in any way, shape, or form. I'm saying that dictating that that is the best way for someone to live their life, and that as a result, you should give up the hopes and dreams and the career aspirations that you had as a result of that perfect pursuit, and claiming that that is the only way that you can serve, that is the best way to serve God, to people who very clearly take God's name, who take God's word very, very, it impacts them very much so, as they're at a Catholic, at a religious school, is a very bad thing to say, a very dangerous thing to say, because you're then claiming that there's only one way for them to serve someone, God, who is very important for them, and that any other way to do that, any other way than serving it in the way that Harrison Butker believes is the best way to serve God, you are not serving God properly, and you are failing as a Christian, because it is a Christian school that he is speaking to. I think that's very manipulative. I think that's very wrong. However, the thing that I really irritates me about all of this doesn't even have to do with Harrison Butker's speech at all. It has to do with the coverage of his speech. And when I say the coverage of his speech, I mean the lack thereof, the media coverage having to do with this speech. I found out about this speech from one singular Bleacher Report post. One Bleacher Report post, and that's it. That's the only thing I heard from this speech. I had to go and Google and do my own research about this speech and Harrison Butker's background in order to get any more information. To this day, it is May 17th, 2024. This is a few days after Harrison Butker made this speech. There is still nothing on the most popular sports media channels. First Take said nothing. ESPN as a whole has said nothing on their major platforms. First Take said nothing. Undisputed has said nothing on Fox Sports. NBA, like nothing. No NFL. The Pat McAfee Show, radio silence. First Things First, nothing. Colin Cowherd said nothing. And the reason I say these people in particular, I didn't even see a tweet about it from any of these people. And I went and looked because I wanted to see if they were going to be held to the same standard as what I'm about to bring up. Nothing. Radio silence from everybody talking about this. And it's not even my place to say that sports coverage shows like First Take or Undisputed or First Things First should cover politics and that it's necessary for them. In fact, in most cases, I believe that it's not really a place because I do believe sports and politics mix, but I don't think that it necessarily needs to be discussed on major news broadcasts all the time, but that's a different opinion to have. But you do not get to do both. You do not get to cover things like athletes declining to go to the White House or Colin Kaepernick's stance on police brutality, or the Deshaun Watson problems, or school shootings on ESPN. All of these, which I believe people would agree, are contemporary issues, however, and controversial issues. However, all of them have a man at the center of the problem, and they're talking about it. However, the second that an athlete speaks on a woman's behalf and makes what I believe are misogynistic comments towards a group of women, and towards women in general, radio silence. Absolutely nothing from any of the major social media networks. Didn't get a single political stance. Suddenly nobody wants to talk about it. Suddenly nobody's calling for politicians or for NFL players or for anything to change their ways or for social reform. There's nothing. Nothing from these media outlets. And I'm not saying that it's their job to do that, because at their base, they are a sports commentary show. They are sports debate shows or sports commentary shows. But you cannot do both. You cannot give your opinion in one area of an, of a topic and not give it in the other area when it is two very major pieces of sports, like of sports, of the sports landscape currently. Harrison Butker isn't nobody. He plays for the world champion Kansas City Chiefs, the back-to-back world champion Kansas City Chiefs, and is giving an opinion that is very controversial and likely, and not likely, does stand against the views that the NFL has come out and like aligned itself with. The NFL, in to do its credit or its detriment, whatever side you stand on here, has come out and claimed that that Harrison Butker's words do not align with its views. That's fine. Most of the NFL's views align with ESPN's views or align with FS1's views, and yet still nothing. It's very hypocritical to me. It shows where interests lie, where priorities lie, and it shows me that whenever these analysts or whatever talk about, you know, the good of women's sports, that they don't really care. They're doing it just for clicks and headlines because their boss says they have to talk about it. But when it comes to actually issues that face women in society, regardless of how big of an issue you feel it is or not, nothing. They don't feel the need to stand up to any, for anything. And so that bothers me, the fact that I didn't see anything when they're so willing to give their opinion on every other issue. But suddenly, you know, somebody says something that is could be perceived as misogynistic. I believe is fairly misogynistic. Not even getting into the talk, not even talking about the LGBTQ portion of his speech, but just talking about the women's aspect of it, because we were talking about Caitlin Clark earlier. Suddenly they don't feel the necessity to bring that up. They don't feel the necessity to debate the merits of that statement. I just think that's very funny. And by funny, I mean extremely laughable and hypocritical of all these major news networks. So yeah, that's the podcast. Sorry to end on such a sour note, but I feel like it was something that needed to be said and I hadn't heard anybody else say. Also, I'm not saying that there aren't any platforms that are making this take or that are speaking up about it. It's just not the major ones that everybody sees and that I believe are, you know, set the standard for a lot of these other smaller platforms. And so that's really a shame, a really big shame. That's the pod. I don't know when I'll do another one of these again, if I'll do another one of these again. I just had some thoughts on my mind that I wanted to get off. It was a lot of fun. I had fun sitting here and talking to myself for, an hour and a half? Not an hour and a half. Hour 6 minutes now? Hour 7 minutes? If you're listening, whoever you are, thanks. If you agree with me, you probably have my cell phone number, so you can text me. Yeah, that's all. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.